dyes and the damp spots on my apron. But she said nothing, merely patting Miranda's shoulder as she passed. "Miranda tells me you're leaving for England," I said, rising and moving unobtrusively out from behind the counter. "We'll be sorry to see you go." "That's kind of you, Mrs. Fraser." She smiled unhappily. "We're sorry to go as well. And I'm not looking forward to the voyage, I can tell you." She spoke with the heartfelt emotion of someone who had made such a voyage before and would strongly prefer to be boiled alive before doing it again. I sympathised very much, having done it myself. Doing it with three children, two of them boys under five, the imagination boggled. I wanted to ask her what had caused them to make such a drastic decision, but couldn't think how to broach the matter in front of Miranda. Something had happened, that was clear. Melanie was jumpy as a rabbit, and something more harried than even packing up a household containing three children might account for. She kept darting glances over her shoulder, as though fearing something sneaking up on her. "Is Mr. Bogues," I began, but was interrupted by a shadow falling across the stoop. Melanie started, hand to her chest, and I whirled round to see who had come. The doorway was filled by a short, stocky woman, dressed in a very odd combination of garments. For an instant, I thought she was an Indian, for she wore no cap, and her dark hair was braided. But then she came into the shop, and I saw that she was white, or rather pink. Her heavy face was flushed with sunburn, and the tip of her pug nose was bright red. "Which one of you is Claire Fraser?" she demanded, looking from me to Melanie Bogues. "I am," I said, repressing an instinctive urge to take a step backward. Her manner wasn't threatening, but she radiated such an air of physical power that I found her rather intimidating. "Who are you?" I spoke from astonishment rather than rudeness, and she didn't seem offended.
"Jezebel Hatfield Morton," she said, squinting intently at me. "Some geezer at the docks telt me that you was a-heading here."
In marked contrast to Melanie Bogues's soft English accent, she had the rough speech I associated with people who had been in the back country for three or four generations, speaking to no one in the meantime, save raccoons, possums, and one another. "Yes," I said, seeing no point in denying it. "Did you need help of some kind?" She didn't look it. Had she been any healthier, she would have burst the seams of the man's shirt she was wearing. Melanie and Miranda were staring at her, wide-eyed. Whatever danger Melanie had been afraid of, it wasn't Miss Morton.
"Not to say help," she said, moving further into the shop.
She tilted her head to one side, examining me with what looked like fascination.
"I was thinking you might know whereabouts that skunk Isaiah Morton be, though."
My mouth dropped open, and I shut it quickly. Not Miss Morton, then. Mrs. Morton. The first Mrs. Isaiah Morton, that is. Isaiah Morton had fought with Jamie's militia company in the War of the Regulation, and he had mentioned his first wife, breaking out in a cold sweat as he did so.
I believe he's working somewhere up country," I said. "Guildford? Or was it Paleyville?"
Actually, it was Hillsborough, but that scarcely mattered, since at the moment he wasn't in Hillsborough. He was, in fact, in Cross Creek, come to take delivery of a shipment of barrels for his employer, a Brewster. I'd seen him at the cooper's shop barely an hour earlier, in company with the second Mrs. Morton and their infant daughter. Jezebel Hatfield Morton didn't look like the sort of person to be civilized about such things. She made a low noise in her throat, indicative of disgust.
"He's a dang slippery little weasel, but I'll catch up to him yet. Don't you trouble none about that."
She spoke with a casual assurance that boded ill for Isaiah. I thought silence was the wiser course, but couldn't stop myself asking, "Why do you want him?" Isaiah possessed a certain uncouth amiability, but viewed objectively, he scarcely seemed the sort to inflame one woman, let alone two.
"Want him?"
She looked amused at the thought,
and rubbed a solid fist under her reddened nose.
"I don't want him. But ain't no man runs out on me for some whey-faced trollop. Once I cotch up to him, I mean to stave his head in and nail his fly-bit hide to my door."
Spoken by another person, this statement might have passed for rhetoric. As spoken by the lady in question, it was an unequivocal declaration of intent. Miranda's eyes were round as a frog's, and her mother's nearly so. Jezebel H. Morton squinted at me and scratched thoughtfully beneath one massive breast, leaving the fabric of her shirt pasted damply to her flesh.
"I hear tell as how you saved the little toad-sucker's life at Alamans. That true?"
Yes. I eyed her warily, watching for any offensive movement. She was blocking the door. If she made for me, I would dive across the counter and dash through the door into the Bogues' living quarters. She was wearing a large pig sticker of a knife, unsheathed. This was thrust through a knotted wampum belt that was doing double duty, holding up a kilted mass of what I thought might originally have been red flannel petticoats, hacked off at the knee. Her very solid legs were bare, as were her feet. She had a pistol and powder horn slung from the belt as well, but made no move to reach for any of her weapons, thank God.
"Too bad," she said dispassionately. "But then, if he died, I'd not have the fun of killing him, so I suppose it's as well. Don't worry me none. If an I don't find him, one of my brothers will."
Business apparently disposed of for the moment, she relaxed a bit and looked around, noticing for the first time the empty shelves.
"What all's going on here?" she demanded, looking interested.
"We're selling up," Melanie murmured, attempting to shove Miranda safely behind her. "Going to England."
"That so?"
Jezebel looked mildly interested.
"What happened? They kill your man, or tar and feather him?"
Melanie went white. "No," she whispered. Her throat moved as she swallowed, and her frightened gaze went toward the door. So that was the threat. I felt suddenly cold, in spite of the sweltering heat.
"Oh, well, if you care whether they do, maybe you best move on down to Centre Street," she suggested helpfully. "They're fixing to make roast chicken out of somebody, sure as God made little green apples. You can smell hot tar all over town, and they's a boiling of folks coming forth from the taverns."
Melanie and Miranda uttered twin shrieks and ran for the door, shoving past the unflappable Jezebel. I was moving rapidly in the same direction, and narrowly avoided a collision as Ralston Bogues stepped through the door just in time to catch his hysterical wife.
"Randy, you go mind your brothers," he said calmly. "Be still, Melly. It's all right."
"Tar," she panted, clutching him. She said...
"Not me," he said,
and I saw that his hair dripped and his face shone pale through its sweat.
"They're not after me. Not yet. It's the printer."
Gently he disengaged his wife's hands from his arm and stepped round the counter, casting a brief glance of curiosity at Jezebel.
"Take the children. Go to Ferguson's," he said,
and pulled a fowling piece from its hiding place beneath the counter.
"I'll come so soon as I may."
He reached into a drawer for the powder horn and cartridge box.
"Ralston,"
Melanie spoke in a whisper, glancing after Miranda's retreating back, but the entreaty was no less urgent for its lack of volume.
"Where are you going?"
One side of his mouth twitched, but he didn't reply.
"Go to Ferguson's," he repeated,
eyes fixed on the cartridge in his hand.
"No, no, don't go. Come with us. Come with me."
She seized his arm, frantic. He shook her off and went doggedly about the business of loading the gun.
"Go, Melly."
"I will not."
Urgent, she turned to me. "Mrs. Fraser, please tell him. Please tell him it's a waste, a terrible waste. He mustn't go." I opened my mouth, unsure what to say to either of them, but had no chance to decide.
"I don't imagine Mistress Fraser will think it a waste, Melly,"
Ralston Bogues said, eyes still on his hands. He slung the strap of the cartridge box over his shoulder
and cocked the gun.
Her husband is holding them off right now.
By himself. He looked up at me then, nodded once, and was gone. Jezebel was right. You could smell tar all over town. This was by no means unusual in the summertime, especially near the warehouse docks. But the hot, thick reek now took on an atmosphere of threat, burning in my nostrils. Tar, and fear aside, I was gasping from the effort to keep up with Ralston Bogues, who wasn't precisely running, but was moving as fast as it was possible to go without breaking into a lope. Jezebel had been right about the people boiling out of taverns, too. The corner of Centre Street was choked with an excited crowd. Mostly men, I saw, though there were a few women of the coarser type among them, fishwives and bond servants. The apothecary hesitated when he saw them. A few faces turned toward him, one or two plucked at their neighbours' sleeves, pointing, and with not very friendly expressions on their faces.
"Get away, Bogues," one man yelled. "It's not your business. Not yet."
Another stooped, picked up a stone, and hurled it. It clacked harmlessly on the wooden walk, a few feet short of Bogues, but it drew more attention. Bits of the crowd were beginning to turn, surging slowly in our direction.
"Papa," said a small, breathless voice behind me.
I turned to see Miranda, cap lost and pigtails unravelling down her back, her face the colour of beetroot from running. There wasn't time to think about it. I picked her up and swung her off her feet toward her father. Taken off guard, he dropped the gun and caught her under the arms. A man lunged forward, reaching for the gun, but I swooped down and got it first. I backed away from him, clutching it to my chest, daring him with my eyes. I didn't know him, but he knew me. His eyes flicked over me, hesitating. Then he glanced back over his shoulder. I could hear Jamie's voice and a lot of others all trying to shout each other down. The breath was still whistling in my chest. I couldn't make out any words. The tone of it was argument, though. Confrontation, not bloodshed. The man wavered, glanced at me, away, then turned and shoved his way back into the gathering crowd. Bogues had had the sense to keep hold of his daughter, who had her arms wrapped tightly round his neck, face buried in his shirt. He darted his eyes at me and made a small gesture as though to take back the gun. I shook my head and held it tighter. The stock was warm and slick in my hands. "Take Miranda home," I said. "I'll do something." It was loaded and primed. One shot. The best I could do with that was to create a momentary distraction, but that might help. I pushed my way through the crowd, the gun pointed carefully down not to spill the powder half hidden in my skirts. The smell of tar was suddenly much stronger. A cauldron of the stuff lay overturned in front of the printer's shop, a black sticky puddle smoking and reeking in the sun. Glowing embers and blackened chunks of charcoal were scattered across the street under everyone's feet. A solid citizen, whom I recognised as Mr. Townsend, was kicking the bejesus out of a hastily built fire, thwarting the attempts of a couple of young men to rebuild it. I looked for Jamie and found him precisely where Ralston Bogues had said he was, in front of the door to the printer's shop, clutching a tar-smeared broom, and with the light of battle in his eye.
"That your man?"
Jezebel Morton had caught up and was peering interestedly over my shoulder.
"Big un, ain't he?"
Tar was spattered all over the front of the shop, and Jamie. A large glob was stuck in his hair, and I could see the flesh of his arm reddened where a long string of hot tar had struck. Despite this, he was grinning. Two more tar-daubed brooms lay on the ground nearby, one broken, almost certainly over someone's head. At least for the moment, he was having fun. I didn't at once see the printer, Fogarty Sims. Then a frightened face showed briefly at the window, but ducked out of sight as a rock flung from the crowd crashed into the window frame, cracking the glass.
"Come out, Sims, you slinking coward," bellowed a man nearby. "Or shall we smoke you out?" "Smoke him! Smoke him!"
Enthusiastic shouts came from the crowd, and a young man near me bent, scrabbling after a burning brand scattered from the fire. I stamped viciously on his hand as he grasped it.
Jesus God!
He let go and fell to his knees, clutching his hand between his thighs, open-mouthed and gasping with pain.
Oh, Jesus!
I edged away, shouldering my way through the press. Could I get near enough to give Jamie the gun? Or would that make matters worse?
Get away from the door, Fraser. We've no quarrel with you.
I recognised that cultivated voice. It was Neil Forbes, the lawyer. He wasn't dressed in his usual natty suiting, though. He wore rough homespun. So it wasn't an impromptu attack. He'd come prepared for dirty work.
Hey, you speak for yourself, Forbes. I've a quarrel with him.
That was a burly man in a butcher's apron, red-faced and indignant, sporting a swollen and empurpled eye.
Look what he did to me.
He waved a meaty hand at the eye, then at the front of his clothing, where a tar-clotted broom had quite evidently caught him square in the chest. He shook a massive fist at Jamie.
You'll pay for this, Fraser.
Aye, but I'll pay you in the same coin, Buchan.
Jamie fainted, broom held like a lance. Buchan yelped and skittered backward, face comically alarmed, and the crowd burst into laughter.
Come back, man. You want to play savage, you'll need a bit more paint.
Buchan had turned to flee, but was blocked by the crowd. Jamie lunged with the broom, smudging him neatly on the seat of his breeches. Buchan leapt in panic at the jab, causing more laughter and hoots of derision as he shoved and stumbled out of range.
The rest of you want to play savage too, do you?
Jamie shouted. He swiped his broom through the steaming puddle and swung it hard in a wide arc before him. Droplets of hot tar flew through the air, and men yelled and pushed to get out of the way, stepping on each other and knocking one another down. I was shoved to one side and fetched up hard against a barrel standing in the street. I would have fallen, save for Jezebel, who caught me by the arm and hauled me up with no apparent effort.
"Yon fella's right rumbustious," she said with approval, eyes fixed on Jamie. "I could admire me a man like that."
"Yes," I said, nursing a bruised elbow. "So could I. Sometimes." Such sentiments appeared not to be universal.
"Give him up, Fraser, or wear feathers with him, friggin' Tories."
The shout came from behind me, and I turned to see that the speaker had come prepared. He clutched a feather pillow in one hand, the end of it already ripped open, so that down feathers flew in spurts with each gesture.
"Tar and feather 'em all."
I turned again at the shout from above and looked up in time to see a young man fling wide the shutters in the upper story of the house on the other side of the street. He was trying to stuff a feather bed through the window, but was being substantially impeded in this endeavour by the housewife whose property it was. This lady had leapt on his back and was beating him about the head with a spurtle, uttering shrieks of condemnation. A young man near me started clucking like a chicken, flapping his elbows to the intense amusement of his friends, who all began to do it too, drowning out any attempts at reason. Not that there was much of that. A chant started up at the far side of the street.
"Tory, Tory, Tory."
The tenor of the situation was changing, and not for the better. I half lifted the fowling piece, unsure what to do, but knowing that I must do something. Another moment, and they'd rush him.
"Give me the gun, Auntie,"
said a soft voice at my shoulder, and I whirled round to find young Ian there, breathing hard. I gave it to him without the slightest hesitation.
"Reste retour," Jamie shouted in French.
"Oui, le tout."
"Stay back, all of you."
He might have been shouting at the crowd, but he was looking at Ian. What the devil did he? Then I caught sight of Fergus, elbowing viciously to keep his place near the front of the crowd. Young Ian, who had been about to raise the gun, hesitated, holding it close. "He's right. Stay back," I said urgently. "Don't fire. Not yet." I saw now that a hasty shot might do more harm than good. Look at Bobby Higgins and the Boston Massacre. I didn't want any massacres taking place in Cross Creek.
particularly not with Jamie at the centre of them. I won't. But I'm no going to let them take him either, Ian muttered. If they go for him.
He broke off, but his jaw was set, and I could smell the sharp scent of his sweat, even above the reek of tar. A momentary distraction had intervened, thank God. Yells from above made half the crowd turn to see what was happening. Another man, evidently the householder, had popped up in the window above, jerking the first man back and punching him. Then the struggling pair disappeared from view, and within a few seconds the sounds of altercation ceased, and the woman's shrieks died away, leaving the feather bed hanging in limp anticlimax, half in and half out of the window. The chant of "Tory, Tory, Tory" had died out during the fascination with the conflict overhead, but was now starting up again, punctuated by bellows for the printer to come out and give himself up.
"Come out, Sims," Forbes bellowed.
I saw that he had equipped himself with a fresh broom and was edging closer to the print shop's door. Jamie saw him too, and I saw his mouth twist with derision. Silas Jameson, the proprietor of a local ordinary, was behind Forbes, crouched like a wrestler, his broad face wreathed in a vicious grin.
"Come out, Sims," he echoed. "What kind of man takes shelter beneath a Scotsman's skirts, eh?"
Jameson's voice was loud enough that everyone heard that, and most laughed, including Jamie.
"A wise one,"
Jamie shouted back, and shook the end of his plaid at Jameson.
"This tartan's sheltered many a poor lad in its time." "And many a lassie too, I'll wager," shouted some ribald soul in the crowd. "What? Do you think I've your wife under my plaid?"
Jamie was breathing hard, shirt and hair pasted to him with sweat, but still grinning as he seized the hem of his kilt.
"You want to come and have a look for her, then?"
"Is there room under there for me too?"
called one of the fishwives promptly. Laughter rolled through the crowd. Fickle as any mob, their mood was changing back from threat to entertainment. I took a deep, trembling breath, feeling sweat roll down between my breasts. He was managing them, but he was walking a razor's edge. If he'd made up his mind to protect Sims, and he had, then no power on earth would make him give the printer up. If the mob wanted Sims, and they did, they'd have to go through Jamie. And they would, I thought, any minute.
"Come out, Sims," yelled a voice from the Scottish lowlands. "You canna be hiding up Fraser's backside all day." "Better a printer up my arse than a lawyer," Jamie shouted back, waving his broom at Forbes in illustration. "They're smaller, aye?"
That made them roar. Forbes was a beefily substantial sort, while Fogarty Sims was a pinched starveling of a man. Forbes went very red in the face, and I saw sly looks being cast in his direction. Forbes was in his 40s, never married, and there was talk.
"I wouldn't have a lawyer up my backside at all," Jamie was shouting happily, poking at Forbes with his broom. "He'd steal your shite and charge you for a clister."
Forbes's mouth opened and his face went purple. He backed up a step and seemed to be shouting back, but no one could hear his response, drowned as it was by the roar of laughter from the crowd.
"And then he'd sell it back to you for night soil," Jamie bellowed the instant he could be heard.
Neatly reversing his broom, he jabbed Forbes in the belly with the handle. The crowd whooped in glee, and Forbes, no kind of a fighter, lost his head and charged Jamie, his own broom held like a shovel. Jamie, who had quite obviously been waiting for some such injudicious move, stepped aside like a dancer, tripped Forbes, and smacked him across the shoulders with the tar-smeared broom, sending him sprawling into the cooling tar puddle, to the raucous delight of the whole street.
"Here, Auntie, hold this."
The fowling piece was thrust suddenly back into my hands.
"What?"
Completely taken aback, I whirled round to see Ian moving fast behind the crowd, beckoning to Fergus. In seconds, unnoticed by the crowd, whose attention was riveted on the fallen Forbes, they had reached the house where the feather bed hung from the window. Ian stooped and cupped his hands.
As though they had rehearsed it for years, Fergus stepped into this improvised stirrup and launched himself upward, swiping at the feather bed with his hook. It caught. He dangled for a moment, grabbing frantically with his sound hand at the hook to keep it from coming off. Ian sprang upward and seized Fergus round the waist, yanking downward. Then the fabric of the bed gave way under their combined weight. Fergus and Ian tumbled to the ground, and a perfect cascade of goose feathers poured out on top of them, only to be caught at once by the thick, damp air and whirled up into a delirious snowstorm that filled the street and plastered the surprised mob with clumps of sticky down. The air seemed filled with feathers. They were everywhere, tickling eyes and nose and throat, sticking to hair and clothes and lashes. I wiped a bit of down from a watering eye and stepped hastily back, away from the half-blind people staggering near me, yelling and bumping into one another. I had been watching Fergus and Ian, but when the feather storm struck, I, unlike everyone else in the street, looked back at the print shop, in time to see Jamie reach through the door, seize Fogarty Sims by the arm, and snatch him out of the shop like a winkle on a pin. Jamie gave Sims a shove that sent him staggering, then whirled back to snatch up his broom and cover the printer's escape. Ralston Bogues, who had been lurking in the shadow of a tree, popped out, a club in his hand, and ran after Sims to protect him, glancing back and brandishing the club to discourage pursuers. This action hadn't gone totally unnoticed, though most of the men were distracted, batting and clawing at the bewildering cloud of feathers that surrounded them. A few had seen what was going on and raised a halloo, yelping like hounds as they tried to push through the crowd in pursuit of the fleeing printer. If ever there was a moment, I'd shoot above their heads and they'd duck, giving Sims time to get away. I raised the gun with decision, reaching for the trigger. The fowling piece was snatched from my grasp so deftly that I didn't realize for an instant that it was gone, but stood staring in disbelief at my empty hands. Then a bellow came from behind me, loud enough to stun everyone nearby into silence.
"Isaiah Morton, you gonna die, boy!"
The fowling piece went off by my ear with a deafening boom and a cloud of soot that blinded me. Choking and coughing, I scrubbed at my face with my apron, recovering sight in time to see the short, pudgy figure of Isaiah Morton a block away, running as fast as his legs would carry him. Jezebel Hatfield Morton was after him in an instant, ruthlessly flattening anyone in her way. She leapt nimbly over a besmeared and befeathered Forbes, who was still on his hands and knees looking dazed, then pushed through the remnants of the mob and hared down the street, short flannel petticoats flying, moving at a surprising rate of speed for someone of her build. Morton careened round a corner and disappeared, implacable fury close on his tail. I felt a trifle dazed myself. My ears were still ringing, but I looked up at a touch on my arm. Jamie was squinting down at me, one eye closed, as though unsure he was seeing what he thought he was seeing. He was saying something I couldn't make out, but the gestures he was making toward my face, coupled with a telltale twitching of the corner of his mouth, made his probable meaning quite clear. "Ha," I said coldly, my own voice sounding tinny and far off. I swiped at my face again with the apron. "You should talk." He looked like a piebald snowman, with black splotches of tar on his shirt, and clumps of white goose down clinging to his brows, his hair, and the stubble of his beard. He said something else, but I couldn't hear him clearly. I shook my head and twisted a finger in my ear, indicating temporary deafness. He smiled, took me by the shoulders, and leaned his head forward until his forehead met mine with a small thunk. I could feel him trembling slightly, but wasn't sure whether it was laughter or exhaustion. Then he straightened up, kissed my forehead, and took me by the arm. Neil Forbes sat in the middle of the street, legs splayed and careful hair dishevelled. He was black with tar from the shoulder to the knee on one side. He'd lost a shoe, and helpful parties were trying to pick the feathers off him. Jamie led me in a wide circle round him, nodding pleasantly as we passed. Forbes looked up, glowering, and said something muffled, heavy face twisting in dislike. On the whole, I thought it was just as well I couldn't hear him. Ian and Fergus had gone off with the majority of the rioters, no doubt to commit mayhem elsewhere. Jamie and I retired to the Sycamore, an inn on River Street, to seek refreshment and make repairs. Jamie's hilarity gradually subsided as I picked tar and feathers off him, but was significantly quenched by hearing an account of my visit to Dr. Fentiman.
"You do what with it?"
Jamie had flinched slightly during my recounting of the tale of Stephen Bonnet's testicle. When I reached a description of the penis syringe, he crossed his legs involuntarily. "Well, you work the needle-like bit down in, of course, and then flush a solution of something like mercuric chloride through the urethra, I suppose."
"Through the,
Do you want me to show you?" I inquired. "I left my basket at the Bogues's, but I can get it, and..."
"No."
He leaned forward and planted his elbows firmly on his knees.
"Do you suppose it burns much?"
"I can't think it's at all pleasant." He shuddered briefly.
"No, I shouldn't think so."
"I don't think it's really effective either," I added thoughtfully. "Pity to go through something like that and not be cured, don't you think?" He was watching me with the apprehensive air of a man who has just realized that the suspicious-looking parcel sitting next to him is ticking.
"What?"
he began, and I hurried to finish. "So you won't mind going round to Mrs. Sylvie's and making the arrangements for me to treat the girls, will you?"
"Who is Mrs. Sylvie?" he asked suspiciously.
"The owner of the local brothel," I said, taking a deep breath. "Dr. Fentiman's maid told me about her. Now, I realise that there might be more than one brothel in town, but I think that Mrs. Sylvie must certainly know the competition, if there is any, so she can tell you..." Jamie drew a hand down over his face, pulling down his lower eyelids so that the bloodshot appearance of his eyes was particularly emphasised.
"A brothel," he repeated. "You want me to go to a brothel?"
"Well, I'll go with you if you like, of course," I said. "Though I think you might manage better alone. I do it myself," I added with some asperity, "but I think they might not pay any attention to me." He closed one eye, regarding me through the other, which looked as though it had been sandpapered.
"Oh, I rather think they would," he said. "So this is what you had in mind when you insisted on coming to town with me, is it?"
He sounded a trifle bitter. "Well, yes," I admitted. "Though I really did need cinchona bark. Besides," I added logically, "if I hadn't come, you wouldn't have found out about Bonnet, or Lucas, for that matter." He said something in Gaelic which I interpreted roughly as an indication that he could have lived quite happily in ignorance of either party. "Besides, you're quite accustomed to brothels," I pointed out. "You had a room in one, in Edinburgh."
"Aye, I did,"
he agreed.
"But I wasn't a marit then, or rather I was, but I mean it quite suited me at the time to have folk think that I..."
He broke off and looked at me pleadingly.
"Sassenach, do you honestly want everyone in Cross Creek to think that I..."
"Well, they won't think that if I go with you, will they?"
"Oh, God."
At this point, he dropped his head into his hands and massaged his scalp vigorously, presumably under the impression that this would help him figure out some means of thwarting me. "Where is your sense of compassion for your fellow man?" I demanded. "You wouldn't want some hapless fellow to be facing a session with Dr. Fentiman's syringe just because you..."
"As long as I'm no required to face it myself," he assured me, raising his head. "My fellow man is welcome to the wages of sin, and serve him just right, too."
"Well, I'm rather inclined to agree," I admitted. "But it isn't only them. It's the women, not just the whores. What about all the wives and the children of the men who get infected? You can't let all of them die of the pox if they can be saved, surely." He had by this time assumed the aspect of a hunted animal, and this line of reasoning didn't improve it.
But the penicillin does not always work, he pointed out. What if it doesn't work on the horse?
It's a possibility, I admitted. But between trying something that might not work and not trying at all... Seeing him still looking squiggle-eyed, I dropped the appeal to reason and resorted to my best weapon. What about young Ian?
What about him?
He replied wearily, but I could see that my words had caused an instant vision to spring up in his mind. Ian wasn't a stranger to brothels, thanks to Jamie, inadvertent and involuntary as the introduction had been.
He's a good lad, Ian, he said stoutly. He wouldn't...
He might, I said, and you know it. I had no idea of the shape of young Ian's private life, if he had one. But he was 21, unattached, and, so far as I could see, a completely healthy young male of the species. Hence, I could see Jamie coming reluctantly to the same conclusions. He had been a virgin when I married him, at the age of 23. Young Ian, owing to factors beyond everyone's control, had been introduced to the ways of the flesh at a substantially earlier age. And that particular innocence couldn't be regained.
"Uh-huh," he said.
He picked up the towel, rubbed his hair ferociously with it, then flung it aside, and gathered back the thick, damp tail, reaching for a thong to bind it. "If it were done when 'tis done, 'twere well it were done quickly," I said, watching with approval. "I think I'd best come too, though. Let me fetch my box." He made no response to this, merely setting grimly about the task of making himself presentable. Luckily, he hadn't been wearing his coat or waistcoat during the contretemps in the street, so he was able to cover the worst of the damage to his shirt.
"Sassenach," he said,
and I turned to find him regarding me with a bloodshot glint.
"Yes?"
"You'll pay for this."
Mrs. Sylvie's establishment was a perfectly ordinary-looking two-storied house, small and rather shabby. Its shingles were curling up at the ends, giving it a slight air of dishevelled surprise, like a woman taken unawares with her hair just out of rollers. Jamie made disapproving Scottish noises in his throat at the sight of the sagging stoop and overgrown yard, but I assumed that this was merely his way of covering discomfiture. I wasn't quite sure what I'd been expecting Mrs. Sylvie to be, the only madam of my acquaintance, having been a rather elegant French émigré in Edinburgh, but the proprietor of Cross Creek's most popular bawdy house was a woman of about 25, with a face as plain as a pie crust and extremely prominent ears. In fact, I had momentarily assumed her to be the maid, and only Jamie's greeting her politely as Mrs. Sylvie informed me that the madam herself had answered the door. I gave Jamie a sideways look, wondering just how he came to be acquainted with her, but then looked again and realized that he had noted the good quality of her gown and the large brooch upon her bosom. She looked from him to me and frowned. "May we come in?" I said, and did so, not waiting for an answer. "I'm Mrs. Fraser, and this is my husband," I said, gesturing toward Jamie, who was looking pink around the ears already.
"Oh," Mrs. Sylvie said warily. "Well, it'll be a pound extra if it's the two of you."
"I beg your... Oh!"
Hot blood flooded my face as I belatedly grasped her meaning. Jamie had got it instantly and was the colour of beetroot.
"It's quite all right," she assured me. "Not the usual, to be sure, but Dotty wouldn't mind a bit, she being somewhat partial to women, you see."
Jamie made a low growling noise indicating that this was my idea and it was up to me to be carrying it out.
"I'm afraid we didn't make ourselves clear," I said, as charmingly as possible. We merely wish to interview your..."
I stopped, groping for an appropriate word. "Not employees, surely?"
Girls,
Jamie put in tersely.
Oh, yes, girls.
Oh, you do?
Her small bright eyes darted back and forth between us. Methody, are you? Or bright light Baptists? Well, that'll be £2, then, for the nuisance.
Jamie laughed.
Cheaper the price, he observed. Or is that per girl?
Mrs. Sylvie's mouth twitched a little.
Oh, per girl, to be sure. £2 per soul. Aye, well, who would put a price on salvation?
He was openly teasing now, and she, having plainly made out that we were neither potential clients nor door-to-door missionaries, was amused, but taking care not to seem so.
I would, she replied dryly. A whore knows the price of everything but the value of nothing, or so I've been told.
Jamie nodded at this.
Aye. What's the price of one of your girls' lives, then, Mrs. Sylvie?
The look of amusement vanished from her eyes, leaving them just as bright, but fiercely wary.
Do you threaten me, sir?
She drew herself up tall and put her hand on a bell that stood on the table near the door.
I have protection, sir, I assure you. You would be well advised to leave at once. If I wished to damage a woman, I should scarcely bring my wife along to watch,
Jamie said mildly.
I'm no so much a pervert as all that.
Her hand, tight on the bell's handle, relaxed a bit.
You'd be surprised, she said. Mind, she said, pointing a finger at him. I don't deal in such things, never think it. But I've seen them. So have I, said Jamie,
the teasing tone gone from his voice.
Tell me, have you maybe heard of a Scotsman called MacDhu?
Her face changed at that. Clearly she had. I was bewildered, but had the sense to keep quiet.
I have, she said.
Her gaze had sharpened.
That was you, was it?
He bowed gravely. Mrs. Sylvie's mouth pursed briefly. Then she seemed to notice me again.
Did he tell you? She asked. I doubt it, I said, giving him an eye. He sedulously avoided my glance.
Mrs. Sylvie uttered a short laugh.
One of my girls went with a man to the Toad, naming a low sort of dive near the river called the Toad and Spoon, and he dealt badly with her, then dragged her out to the tap room and offered her to the men there. She said she knew she was dead. You know it is possible to be raped to death.
This last was addressed to me in a tone that mingled aloofness with challenge.
I do, I said, very shortly.
A brief qualm ran through me and my palms began to sweat.
A big Scotchman was there, though, and he took issue with the proposal, apparently. It was him alone, though, against a mob. Your speciality, I said to Jamie under my breath,
and he coughed.
But he suggested that they deal cards for the girl. Played a game of brag, and won.
Really? I said politely. Cheating at cards was another of his specialities, but one I tried to discourage his using, convinced that it would get him killed one day. No wonder he hadn't told me about this particular adventure.
So he picked up Alice, wrapped her in his plaid, and brought her home. Left her at the door.
She looked at Jamie with grudging admiration.
So, have you come to claim a debt, then? You have my thanks for what they may be worth. A great deal, madam, he said quietly. But no, we've come to try to save your girls from worse than drunken raperies.
Her thin brows arched high in question.
From the pox, I said baldly. Her mouth fell open.
For all her relative youth, Mrs. Sylvie was a hard customer and no easy sell. While fear of the pox was a constant factor in the life of a whore, talk of spirochetes cut no ice with her, and my proposition that I inject her staff, there were only three girls, it appeared, with penicillin, met with a firm refusal. Jamie allowed the wrangling to go on until it became clear we had reached a stone wall. Then he came in on a different tack.
"My wife isn't proposing such a course only from the goodness of her heart, Ken," he said.
By now we had been invited to sit, in a neat little parlour adorned with gingham curtains, and he leaned forward gingerly so as not to strain the joints of the delicate chair he was sitting on. The son of a friend came to my wife, saying he'd contracted the syphilis from a whore in Hillsborough. She saw the sore. There's no question, but that lad is poxed. He panicked, though, before she was able to treat him, and ran. We've been looking for him ever since, and heard just yesterday that he'd been seen here, in your establishment. Mrs. Silby lost control of her face in an instant. It was back in a moment, but there was no mistaking the look of horror.
Oh, she said hoarsely, a Scotch lad? What did he look like?
Jamie exchanged a brief quizzical glance with me and described Manfred MacGillivray. By the time he had finished, the young madam's face was white as a sheet.
I had him, she said, twice.
Oh, Jesus! She took a couple of deep breaths, though, and rallied.
He was clean, though. I made him show me. I always do.
I explained that while the canker healed, the disease remained in the blood only to emerge later. After all, had she not known of whores who contracted syphilis without any exhibition of a previous sore?
Yes, of course, but they can't have taken proper care, she said, jaw set stubbornly. I always do, and my girls too. I insist upon it.
I could see denial setting in. Rather than admit she might be harbouring a deadly infection, she would insist it wasn't possible, and within moments would have talked herself into believing it and would throw us out. Jamie could see it too.
Mrs. Silby, he said, interrupting her flow of justifications. She looked at him, blinking. Have you a deck of cards in the house? What? Yes, of course. Bring them then, he said with a smile. Cleek, loo or brag. Your choice.
She gave him a long, hard look, her mouth pressed tight. Then it relaxed a little.
Honest cards? She asked, and a small gleam showed in her eye. And for what stakes? Honest cards, he assured her. If I win, my wife injects the lot of you. And if you lose? A cask of my best whiskey.
She hesitated a moment longer, eyeing him narrowly, estimating the odds. There was still a blob of tar in his hair and feathers on his coat, but his eyes were deep blue and guileless. She sighed and put out a hand.
Done, she said.
Did you cheat? I asked, grasping his arm to keep from stumbling. It was well after dark by now, and the streets of Cross Creek weren't lighted, save by starlight.
Didn't I have to, he said, and yawned hugely. She may be a good whore, but she's no hand at cards. She should have chosen loo, that's mostly luck, while brag takes skill. Easier to cheat at loo, though, he added, blinking.
What exactly constitutes a good whore? I asked curiously. I had never considered the question of qualifications anent that profession, but supposed there must be some, beyond possession of the requisite anatomy and a willingness to make it available. He laughed at that, but scratched his head, considering.
Well, it helps if she has a genuine liking for men, but doesn't take them very serious. And if she likes to go to bed, that's as well, too.
Ouch! I had stepped on a rock, and, tightening my grip on his arm, had got him on the patch of skin burned by tar earlier in the day. Oh, sorry. Is it bad? I have a bit of balm I can put on it when we get to the inn.
Och, no, just blisters. It will bide.
He rubbed his arm gingerly, but shrugged off the discomfort, and, taking me by the elbow, led me round the corner toward the main street. We had decided earlier that since we might be late, we would stay at McClanahan's King's Inn, rather than make the long drive back to River Run. The smell of hot tar still permeated this end of town, and the evening breeze swirled feathers into small drifts at the side of the road. Now and then a down feather floated past my ear like a slow-moving moth.
I wonder, are they still picking the feathers off Neil Forbes?
Jamie said, a grin in his voice.
"Maybe his wife will just put a bolster cover on him and use him as a pillow," I suggested.
"No, wait, he hasn't got a wife. They'll have to..."
"Call him a rooster and put him out in the yard to serve the hens," Jamie suggested, giggling. "He's a fine cock-a-doodle, if no much in the way of a cock."
He wasn't drunk. We had drunk weak coffee with Mrs. Sylvie after the injections, but he was desperately tired. We both were. And suddenly in the state of exhaustion where the lamest joke seems immensely funny. And we staggered, bumping together and laughing at worse and worse jokes until our eyes teared.
"What's that?"
Jamie said suddenly, drawing a deep, startled breath through his nose.
"What's burning?"
"Something substantial. There was a glow in the sky, visible over the roofs of the nearby houses, and the sharp scent of burning wood suddenly overlaid the thicker smell of hot tar. Jamie ran toward the corner of the street, with me hot on his heels. It was Mr. Sims's print shop, well ablaze. Evidently, his political enemies, balked of their prey, had decided to vent their animosity on his premises. A knot of men was milling in the street, much as they had earlier in the day. Again, there were calls of, "Tory!" and a few were brandishing torches. More men were running down the street toward the scene of the fire, shouting. I caught a bellow of, "Goddamn Whigs!" And then the two groups collided in a flurry of shoving and punching. Jamie grabbed my arm and propelled me back the way we had come, out of sight around the corner. My heart was pounding, and I was short of breath. We ducked under a tree and stood panting.
"Well," I said, after a short silence, filled with the shouts of the riot, "I suppose Fergus will have to find a different occupation. There's an apothecary shop going cheap, I know."
Jamie made a small sound, not quite a laugh.
"He'd do better to go into partnership with Mrs. Sylvie," he said. "There's a business not subject to politics. Come on, Sassnach. We'll go the long way round."
When at length we reached the inn, we found young Ian fidgeting on the porch, watching out for us.
"Where in the name of bride have you been?" he demanded severely, in a manner that made me think suddenly of his mother. "We've been combing the town for you, Uncle Jamie. And Fergus, sure you'd been caught up in the collie shangy yonder and maimed or killed."
He nodded toward the print shop. The blaze was beginning to die, though there was still enough light from it to see his face set in a disapproving frown.
"We've been doing good deeds," Jamie assured him piously, "visiting the sick, as Christ commands us."
"Oh, aye," Ian responded with considerable cynicism.
"He said you should visit those in prison, too. Too bad you didn't start with that."
"What?
Why?
Yon bugger Don has escaped, that's for why," Ian informed him,
seeming to take a grim pleasure in imparting bad news.
"During the fight this afternoon, the jailer came to join in the fun and left the door on the latch. The bugger just walked out into war."
Jamie inhaled deeply, then let his breath out slowly, coughing slightly from the smoke.
"Aye, well," he said, "so we're down by one print shop and one thief, but four whores to the good. Do you think that a fair exchange, Sassenach?"
"Whores?" Ian exclaimed, startled.
"What whores?"
"Mrs. Sylvie's," I said, peering at him. He looked shifty, though perhaps it was only the light. "Ian, you didn't."
"Well, of course he did, Sassenach," Jamie said, resigned. "Look at him."
A guilty expression was spreading over Ian's features like an oil slick on water, easy to make out, even by the flickering, ruddy light of the dying fire.
"I've found out about Manfred," Ian offered hastily. "He went downriver, meaning to find a ship in Wilmington."
"Yes, we found that out too," I said a little testily. "Who was it? Mrs. Sylvie? Or one of the girls?"
His large Adam's apple bobbed nervously.
"Mrs. Sylvie," he said, in a low voice.
"Right," I said. "Fortunately, I have some penicillin left, and a nice dull syringe. Inside with you, Ian, you abandoned wretch, and down with your breeks." Mrs. McClanahan, emerging onto the porch to inquire whether we would like a bit of late supper, overheard this and gave me a startled look, but I was well past caring. Some time later, we lay at last in the haven of a clean bed, safe from the upheavals and turmoils of the day. I had pried the window open, and the faintest of breezes disturbed the heaviness of the thick, hot air. Several soft grey flecks drifted in, feathers or bits of ash, spiralling like snowflakes toward the door. Jamie's arm lay across me, and I could make out the soft, glaucous shapes of the blisters that covered most of his forearm. The air was harsh with burning, but the smell of tar lay like an abiding threat beneath. The men who had burned Sims' shop, and come so close to burning Sims, and likely Jamie as well, were rebels in the making, men who would be called patriots.
"I can hear you thinking, Sassenach," he said.
He sounded peaceful, on the verge of sleep.
"What is it?"
"I was thinking of tar and feathers," I said softly, and very gently touched his arm. "Jamie, it's time."
"I know,"
he answered, just as softly. Some men went by in the street outside, singing drunkenly with torches. The flickering light flowed across the ceiling and was gone. I could feel Jamie watch it go, listening to the raucous voices as they faded down the street. But he said nothing, and after a bit, the big body that cradled me began to relax, sinking once again toward sleep. "What are you thinking?" I whispered, not sure whether he could still hear me.
He could. "I was thinking that you'd make a really good whore, Sassenach. Were you at all promiscuous?"
he replied drowsily.
"What?" I said, quite startled. "But I'm glad you're not," he added,
and began to snore. Chapter 57. The Minister's Return. September the 4th, 1774. Roger steered clear of Coopersville on his way home. It wasn't that he feared Uta MacGillivray's wrath, but he didn't want to tarnish the happiness of his homecoming with coldness nor confrontation. Instead, he took the long way round, winding his way gradually up the steep slope toward the ridge, pushing through overgrown parts where the forest had taken back the path, and fording small streams. His mule splashed out of the last of these at the base of the trail, shaking itself and scattering droplets from its belly. Pausing to wipe sweat from his face, he spotted a movement on a large stone by the bank. Aidan, fishing, affecting not to have seen him. Roger reined Clarence up alongside and watched for a moment, saying nothing. Then he asked,
"Are they biting well?"
"Tolerable," Aidan replied, squinting hard at his line. Then he looked up, a huge grin splitting his face from ear to ear, and flinging down his pole, sprang up, reaching with both hands so that Roger could grasp his skinny wrists and swing him up onto the saddle in front of him. "You're back!" he exclaimed, throwing his arms about Roger and burying his face happily in Roger's chest. "I waited for you. Are you a real minister now, then?"
"Almost. How did you know I'd be along today?"
Aidan shrugged. "I've been waiting the best part of a week, have I no?" He looked up into Roger's face, round-eyed and quizzical. "You didn't look any different."
"I'm not," Roger assured him, smiling. "How's the belly?"
"Prime. You want to see my scar?" He leaned back, pulling up his ratty shirt-tail to display a neat red 4-inch weal across the pallid skin.
"Well done," Roger approved. "Taking care of your mam and wee Ori, then, now you're mended, I suppose."
"Oh, aye." Aidan puffed his narrow chest. "I brought home 6 trout for supper last night, and the biggest one the size of me arm." He stuck out a forearm in illustration.
"Ah, get on with you."
"I did, then," Aidan said indignantly, then twigged that he was being teased, and grinned. Clarence was becoming restive, wanting home, and turned in little circles, stamping his feet and twitching at the reins.
Best go. You want to ride up with me?
Aidan looked tempted, but shook his head.
Nah, then. I promised Mrs. Ogilvy as I would come and tell her the minute you came.
Roger was surprised at that.
Oh, aye? Why's that?
She's had a wean last week. What, she wants you to baptise?
Oh?
His heart rose a little at that, and the bubble of happiness he carried inside him seemed to expand a little.
His first christening.
Or rather, his first official baptism, he thought, with a small pang at the memory of the small O'Brien girl he had buried without a name. He wouldn't be able to do it until after his ordination, but it was something to look forward to.
"Tell her I'll be glad to christen the wean," he said, lowering Aidan to the ground. "Have her send to tell me when. And then I forget your wee fish," he called.
Aidan grabbed up his pole and the string of silvery fish, none of them longer than the length of a hand, and plunged off into the wood, leaving Roger to turn Clarence's head toward home. He smelled smoke from a good way down the trail, stronger than chimney smoke. With all the talk he had heard on his way regarding the recent events in Cross Creek, he couldn't help a small feeling of uneasiness and urged Clarence on with a nudge of the heels. Clarence, scenting home, even through the smoke, took the hint with alacrity and trotted briskly up the steep incline. The smell of smoke grew stronger, mixed with an odd, musty sort of scent that seemed vaguely familiar. A visible haze grew among the trees, and when they burst out of the undergrowth into the clearing, he was nearly standing in his stirrups with agitation. The cabin stood, weathered and solid, and relief dropped him back in the saddle with a force that made Clarence grunt in protest. Smoke rose around the house in thick swirls, though, and the figure of Brianna, swathed like a muslin with a scarf around her head and face, was dimly visible in the midst of it. He dismounted, took a breath to call out to her, and immediately suffered a coughing fit. The damned groundhog kiln was open, belching smoke like hell's chimney, and now he recognised the musty scent, scorched earth.
"Roger! Roger!"
She'd seen him, and came running, skirts and scarf ends flying, leaping a stack of cut turves like a mountain goat to hurl herself into his arms. He grabbed her and held on, thinking that nothing in life had ever felt better than the solid weight of her against him, and the taste of her mouth, in spite of the fact that she'd plainly eaten onions for lunch. She emerged beaming and wet-eyed from the embrace, long enough to say, "I love you," then grabbed his face and kissed him again.
"I missed you. When did you shave last? I love you."
"4 days ago, when I left Charlotte." "I love you too. Is everything all right?"
"Sure. Well, actually, no. Jemmy fell out of a tree and knocked out a tooth, but it was a baby tooth, and Mama says she doesn't think that it will hurt the permanent one coming in. And Ian got exposed to syphilis, maybe, and we're all disgusted with him. And I was nearly tarred and feathered in Cross Creek, and we met Flora MacDonald, and Mama stuck a needle in Aunt Jocasta's eye, and..."
"Ugh," Roger said in instinctive revulsion. "Why?"
"So it wouldn't burst. And I got paid £6 in painting commissions," she concluded triumphantly. "I bought some fine wire and silk to make paper screens with, and enough wool for a winter cloak for you. It's green. The biggest thing, though, is we met another..." "Well, I'll tell you about that later. It's complicated.
How did it go with the Presbyterians? Is it all right? Are you a minister?" He shook his head, trying to decide which part of this cataract to respond to, and ended up choosing the last bit, only because he could remember it.
"Sort of. Have you been taking lessons in incoherence from Mrs. Bug?"
"How can you be sort of a minister? Wait, tell me in a minute. I have to open it up some more."
With that, she was flitting back across the broken ground toward the gaping hole of the kiln. The tall, clay-brick chimney stack rose at one end, looking like a headstone. The scorched turves that had covered it in operation were scattered round it, and the general impression was that of an enormous smoking grave from which something large, hot, and doubtlessly demonic, had just arisen. Had he been Catholic, he would have crossed himself.
As it was, he advanced carefully toward the edge, where Brianna was kneeling, reaching across with her shovel to remove another layer of turves from the willow-work frame that arched across the top of the pit. Looking down through a roiling haze of smoke, he could see irregularly shaped objects lying on the earthen shelves that lined the pit. A few he could make out as being bowls or platters. Most of them, though, were vaguely tubular objects, 2 or 3 feet long, tapered and rounded at one end, the other slightly flared. They were a dark pinkish colour, streaked and darkened with smoke, and looked like nothing so much as a collection of giant barbecued phalluses, a notion that he found nearly as disturbing as the story of Jocasta's eyeball.
"Pipes," Brianna said proudly, pointing her shovel at one of these objects. "For water. Look, they're perfect. Or they will be, if they don't crack while they're cooling."
"Terrific,"
Roger said, with a decent show of enthusiasm.
"Hey, I brought you a present."
Reaching into the side pocket of his coat, he brought out an orange, which she seized with a cry of delight, though she paused for an instant before digging her thumb into the peel.
"No, you eat it. I've got another for Jem," he assured her.
"I love you," she said again, fervently, juice running down her chin.
"What about the Presbyterians? What did they say?"
"Oh, well, basically, it's all right. I've got the university degree and enough Greek and Latin to impress them. The Hebrew was a bit lacking, but if I mug that up in the meantime, Reverend Caldwell gave me a book."
He patted the side of his coat. "Yes, I can just see you preaching in Hebrew to the Crombies and Buchanans," she said, grinning.
"So, what else?"
There was a fleck of orange pulp stuck to her lip, and he bent on impulse and kissed it off, the tiny burst of sweetness rich and tart on his tongue.
"Well, they examined me as to doctrine and understanding, and we talked a great deal, prayed together for discernment."
He felt somewhat shy talking to her about it. It had been a remarkable experience, like returning to a home he'd never known he'd missed. To confess his calling had been joyful. To do it among people who understood and shared it.
"So I'm provisionally a minister of the word," he said, looking down at the toes of his boots. "I'll need to be ordained before I can administer sacraments like marriage and baptism, but that will have to wait until there's a presbytery session held somewhere. In the meantime, I can preach, teach, and bury."
She was looking at him, smiling, but a little wistfully.
"You're happy," she said,
and he nodded, unable to speak for a moment.
"Very happy," he said at last, his voice hardly audible.
"Good,"
she said softly, and smiled a little more genuinely.
"I understand. So now you're sort of handfast with God. Is that it?"
He laughed and felt his throat ease.
God, he'd have to do something about that. He couldn't be preaching drunk every Sunday. Talk of giving scandal to the faithful. "Aye, that's it. But I'm properly married to you. I'll not forget it."
"See that you don't."
Her smile now was wholehearted.
"Since we are married..."
She gave him a very direct look, one that went through him like a mild electric shock.
"Jim's at Masali's, playing with Germain. And I've never made love to a minister before. It seems kind of wicked and depraved, don't you think?"
He took a deep breath, but it didn't help. He still felt giddy and light-headed, doubtless from the smoke.
"Behold, thou art fair, my beloved. Yea, pleasant," he said. "And our bed is green. The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. Thy navel is like a round goblet, which wanteth not liquor. Thy belly is like an heap of wheat set about with lilies."
He reached out and touched her, gently.
Thy two breasts are like two young roses that are twins.
They are?
As in the Bible,
he assured her gravely.
It must be so, aye?
Tell me more about my navel, she said. But before he could, he saw a small form bounding out of the woods and herring toward them, Aidan, now fishless and panting.
Mrs. Ogilvy says, come now, he blurted.
He gasped a little, recovering enough breath for the rest of the message.
The wain, she's poorly, and they want her christened in case she should die.
Roger clapped a hand to his other side. The Book of Common Worship that they'd given him in Charlotte was a small, reassuring weight in his pocket.
Can you?
Brianna was looking at him worriedly.
Catholics can. I mean, a lay person can baptize someone if it's an emergency.
Yes.